for possible signatures of quantum gravity, and then tell you about our latest results for searches for astrophysical neutrinos and how that might impact some of the ideas that we've heard discussed here. So IceCube is a bit of a weird detector. It's actually a cubic kilometer of ice located essentially underneath the geographic South Pole. And so there's not actually that much to see from the air. This is an aerial photograph of the South Pole. Here's the South Pole station here. This is the skiway where planes land during the summer season. The IceCube control room is this building here. This is where our surface readout computers and computing cluster are located. And this hexagonal structure here is the area under which we've buried the IceCube detector. And we basically use the large amounts of extremely clear ice under the South Pole as a target for neutrinos, which, as you know, have a very small cross-section, and thus we need a huge target in order to detect them. So if you could see underneath the ice, this is basically what you would see here. What we've done to build the detector is to drill holes into the ice about 2.5 kilometers deep. And into these holes, we lower cables, or which we also call strings. And along these strings, we place these digital optical modules, which are basically a big photomultiplier tube in a glass pressure sphere with some associated digitizing readout electronics and calibration devices. And along each one of these strings, we have about 80 of these DOMs, as we call them. And we have in total 86 of these strings, so about over 5,000 of these modules in the ice, instrumenting, as I mentioned, about a cubic kilometer. In addition to the in-ice detector, we have a surface array called IceTop, which is very similar conceptually, although much smaller, to the Auger experiment, which we heard about from Marcus. They're here ice Cherenkov tanks. And there's also a couple of sub-detectors. In the center, in the deepest, clearest ice of IceCube, we have a more densely populated region of the detector called deep core. This is for focusing on lower energies. And then here in this blue region, you can see where the predecessor to IceCube, which was called Amanda, was located. And although this has been now disconnected for a few years, but it took data starting from about the late 90s and into the 2000s. So how do we actually use this detector to find neutrinos? Well, let me give you an example starting with the kind of the easiest type of neutrino for us to detect, and that's a muon neutrino. If a muon neutrino comes in and interacts via charge current interaction with the ice or with the bedrock underneath the detector, you get an outgoing high energy muon. If this muon goes through the detector, it leaves a trail of Cherenkov light. And using the precise timing of when this light hits our various modules, we can reconstruct the direction of where this muon and thus the neutrino came from quite well. But mostly what we don't see are neutrinos. Mostly what we see are the cosmic ray muons from cosmic ray air showers. So we have a huge background. We're seeing about 2,000 of these per second. So in order to screen out these, we basically look through the Earth and look for events where the muon is coming up through the detector. And this indicates that because no muon can pass through the entire Earth, that it had to be a neutrino coming in and interacting near the detector here. Now, primarily, these are going to be atmospheric neutrinos, which are, again, are produced in cosmic ray interactions in the atmosphere, but now on the other side of the Earth. But we are also looking for astrophysical neutrinos above the background of atmospheric neutrinos. So these are some events to give you an idea of what these look like in the detector. This is one that I was just talking about, an upgoing muon neutrino event that interacted somewhere here, maybe back here even, and then the muon going upward through the detector. These we call track-like events, but we're actually not only sensitive to muon neutrino events, we're sensitive to neutral current events, interactions of all flavors, so nu e, nu mu, and nu tau. and also charge current, electron, and tau neutrino of events. But these have a different topology for us. We call these cascades because instead of leaving this long muon track, they deposit their energy more in a ball in the detector. And I'll kind of talk about the different trade-offs between these event types in a minute. And this is our primary background. We have these high-energy muon bundles coming downward, starting here and going down through here. But I'll just point out, at some point, at PEV energies and above, the Earth actually does become opaque even to neutrinos. And so then we have to start looking for downgoing neutrino events above this atmospheric background. So just to give you a kind of an idea of the energy ranges that are interesting to IceCube, so for the primary detector, not counting deep core, our energy threshold is about 100 GeV or so. And atmospheric neutrinos really dominate up to about 100 TeV. above these energies of 100 TeV or so, there are a couple of possible sources. One are the so-called prompt atmospheric neutrinos. These are from charmed meson production in the atmosphere, again, from cosmic ray interactions. These should turn on at about, or poke above the atmospheric neutrino spectrum, about 300 TeV. Cosmic ray accelerators, we're looking at energies basically above 100 TeV. And the so-called cosmogenic neutrinos from cosmic ray, ultra-high energy cosmic ray, cosmic microwave background interactions are way up at 10 to the 6 TeV. And I'll talk a bit about each of those later. So the detector actually works quite well. It actually has been working better than we thought it would. And here's kind of to show you the difference in performance between track-like events or muon neutrino events and cascade events. The trade-off here is tracks are obviously great for angular resolution, so we can reconstruct the direction of the neutrino to about a degree. But energy estimation is really hard because, A, we don't even see the initial interaction, possibly. It could have been way somewhere outside of the detector, and we have this muon with a range of many kilometers coming in. But we can get a handle on the neutrino energy by measuring the muon energy loss as it passes through the detector. And with this, you can get an idea to about 30% in the logarithm of the energy. Cascades are kind of the other way around. So if you can imagine, if you have a neutrino interaction and this cascade in the detector, you have a nice calorimetric measurement of the energy. So here our energy resolution is quite good, 30-35% linearly in the neutrino energy. But our angular resolution is much worse. It's difficult to figure out the direction of this blob. But this is rapidly improving, and I think with high energy events, we might even be able to get down to about 10 degrees or so. And these are sort of high level plots, but there's a whole array of calibration that we do to support this. For example, we continually time synchronize all of the 5400 DOMs every second to a precision of about 2 nanoseconds. And we measure the optical properties of the ice, which is actually very important for us, so the scattering and absorption length as a function of depth with flashing LEDs that we have on each of the DOMs. And finally, one of the, just in terms of the detector performance, and then I'll go on to some more physics, one fun check that we can do to verify, A, that we know where we're pointing, but also what our angular resolution is to actually look for the moon. So the moon is not a source, obviously, of neutrinos or cosmic rays, but it's an anti-source because it blocks cosmic rays from hitting the atmosphere. And so if we follow where the moon is in the sky, we can basically see the shadow of the moon in cosmic rays with IceCube. And this, A, lets us know, okay, we really do know where we're pointing, so we haven't screwed up the coordinate system, and we can measure our angular resolution with this. And it validates that this degree is about right. So IceCube has been under construction for quite a few years, but we actually finished the construction in late 2010, but we've been doing physics analyses all during the construction process. So if you look up ice cube papers, you'll see kind of a funny, some funny jargon about which configuration of the detector this analysis was. And this has been changing every year, but now it's stabilized. But we started off with what we call IC22, so an IC9, so the 9 and 22 strings of the detector, moving on to IC40, 40 strings, 59 strings, 79 strings, and then starting at the beginning of 2011, the full 86 strings of the detector. So how might we search for possible signatures of quantum gravity with IceCube? Well, the first step, which is actually kind of tricky, is that we need a neutrino source. We don't have an accelerator beam to work with. The nice thing is that atmospheric neutrinos from these cosmic ray interactions in the atmosphere are there. They're our high statistic source, so there are some searches that we can do with those that I'll tell you about. One of IceCube's main physics goals moving forward is to identify what the cosmic ray accelerators in our galaxy and outside of our galaxy are by looking for neutrinos associated with cosmic ray acceleration. So that's kind of one of the astrophysics goals of IceCube. So we do that by looking for static neutrino point sources in the sky, and then we also look for transient sources like GRBs, flaring AGN, and I'll show you that. And also, we can look for ultra-high-energy neutrinos, which I mentioned before, with these cosmic microwave background interactions. So let me start with atmospheric neutrinos. I already showed you what they are. They're produced, they're primarily muon neutrinos. There is a small flux of electron neutrinos, but for us, it's primarily a neutrino and muon neutrino and antineutrino flux. And we've actually been measuring the atmospheric neutrino spectrum for many years now. And this is a summary of those results. So this is the atmospheric muon neutrino flux. It's a quite steep power law spectrum. This is multiplied by E squared to flatten it out a little bit. But it falls at like E to the minus 3.7 or so. And this is versus neutrino energy. And these results here include both the AMANDA and IceCube atmospheric neutrino results. And you can see the energy range that we're talking about here from about 100 GeV to where we run out of statistics, just because the flux is getting smaller and smaller at higher energies, at a few hundred TeV. In AMANDA, we had a pretty decent sample of atmospheric neutrinos to work with, but because the detector was smaller, we only saw about 4 per day. We're up to about 200 atmospheric neutrinos per day in IceCube. And this is the energy region where we'll focus on looking for neutrino point sources, a diffuse high energy flux of neutrinos from the combined cosmic ray accelerator population in the universe and the cosmogenic neutrino flux. But what can we do with this spectrum? Well, this neutrino sample is mostly above the atmospheric oscillation regime, and by that I mean the normal mass-induced oscillations that, for example, Super Kamiokande has observed. So these turn off at Earth baselines at somewhere around 10 to 50 GeV or so. So if we see any kind of unexpected flavor transitions, this could indicate, for example, a Lorentz violation. A specific form of this can induce neutrino oscillations at higher energies, or quantum decoherence. And so what this would look like to us is somewhere along this pathway, we have some kind of new physics setting in, either Lorentz violation or decoherence of this muon neutrino, not really a beam, but source. And then for us, it would look like all of a sudden part of our muon neutrinos would disappear at higher energies. So some of you have heard me talk a bit before about our searches for Lorentz violation. We've covered some of the SME, standard model extension, stuff here before. So I want to focus today more on this quantum decoherence phenomenon. So the heuristic picture here, and this is going to be very hand-wavy, and I apologize for that, is that you have some kind of foamy structure of space-time, and these neutrinos may interact with this space-time foam or virtual black holes popping in and out of the vacuum, however you want to think about it. The upshot is, for us, is that a pure quantum state would interact with this environment and decohere to a superposition of flavor states. And I'm going to basically skip all the formalism and refer to you this to this nice phenomenological paper. But the basic idea is that you take this density matrix propagation equation, and then you add this Lindblad form with these decoherence operators to model this. And if you plug this all the way through to what this would look like in the atmospheric neutrino sector, you get this equation. This is the survival probability of an atmospheric muon neutrino. So what's the probability that it remains an atmospheric neutrino at the detector? And this is a hideous equation with these decoherence terms in it, and it also has the standard mass-induced oscillation terms in it. But the important things in here is, after this decoherence sets in, we have this 1:1:1 electron muon to tau flavor ratio, and there's this characteristic exponential behavior. So this decoherence has this, looks like a damping, essentially, of the flavor ratio. And there are a number of phenomenological models of what this looks like. So here's this is L, this is the decoherence length, so how far the neutrino has traveled. And this decoherence parameter, the key question is, how does this depend on neutrino energy? And there's a number of models out there. There's the N equals minus one model here. I believe you can have it preserve Lorentz invariance. But what I'm going to focus on today are the models with a higher or a stronger energy dependence, and that's because that's really where IceCube and Amanda can contribute to looking for these or for constraining this parameter space because of our higher energy reach. And in particular, there's this model by Ellis and developed by Baron Boim and Mavromatos and others. Where this is, that you have an E squared dependence here, and this comes out of their recoiling D-brain scenario. So again, what does this look like to us? This again is the same atmospheric neutrino survival probability in this E squared decoherence model. This is the zenith angle of the incoming atmospheric neutrino, which is a proxy for this decoherence length. So you have a very short path length here if the neutrino is coming in from this direction versus the longest possible path length, the diameter of the Earth, if the neutrino is coming straight upward going. And this is neutrino energy here. This is the last minimum of the normal mass-induced oscillations. And then at some critical energy, which depends on the size of this decoherence parameter, you have this decoherence effect set in, and all of a sudden you've lost two-thirds of your muon neutrino sample as they've decohered into other flavors. So we looked specifically for this in 7 years of Amanda data, and as you might guess, we did not find quantum decoherence. Here are the data. This is a plot of the zenith angle, and this is not neutrino energy, it's a simple energy proxy, which is just the number of modules in the detector that's hit. And the data points are in black, and these are just two standard, no new physics, atmospheric neutrino models. And you can see our data are consistent with this, with possibly about a 1% background contamination. So we used this to set limits on the quantum decoherence parameter. And I mean, there are different parameters that fall out of this equation, but if you just, let's focus on this E squared model for a second and just set all of these D sub I's equal, then we find an upper limit of about 10 to the minus 31 inverse GeV for this E squared model. Now you may say, it's hard to say, okay, how interesting is this? Naively, if you just say, okay, what if this decoherence parameter is some little d of order 1, and we have some n minus 1 suppression via the Planck mass here? Then for this n equals 2 case, we're actually far below, our upper limit is far below this natural hand-wavy explanation here. So it's about 1 times 10 to the minus 12. where we naively would expect this to be one. For the each of the cubed model, we're not at this d star equals one, perhaps interesting regime yet. We're about a factor of 900 off. And similar analysis methods can be used to set limits on violation of Lorentz invariance, and I'll just refer you to this, this PRD paper. So now astrophysical sources, neutrino sources, would be more powerful probes of quantum gravity. If you want to continue with this decoherence approach, it actually gets kind of tricky, and that's because the standard neutrino cosmic ray source produces a flavor ratio of one electron to two muon to no tau neutrinos at the source. And this normal oscillations will actually smear this to 1 to 1 to 1 at Earth, which is the same that you would expect from quantum decoherence. So in order to really study decoherence over galactic or extragalactic distances, you need a source with a special flavor ratio. And so, I mean, there are some theories out there. For example, this Cygnus OB2 star-forming region might be interesting, and you can possibly get an electron antineutrino source here, but we have to go look for that. Other possibilities are distortions in high-energy neutrino spectra and time delays from GLRBs. But the main point here is that the next step is we have to find an astrophysical neutrino source. And so I'll tell you where we are there. So let me talk first about searching for static neutrino point sources. So cosmic ray accelerators in the universe should also produce neutrinos if they're accelerating protons or heavy nuclei. And the way we do this is quite simple. We basically just take an isotropic background of atmospheric neutrinos in the northern hemisphere, so coming upward through the Earth, or cosmic ray muons coming downward, and look for some kind of clustering. We actually can look for point sources in both hemispheres. So obviously, northern hemisphere sources are better for IceCube because we have this Earth screening effect, but we can also look for sources in the southern hemisphere. However, the energy regime is much higher, so we have to only look at higher energy events to cut out some of this cosmic ray background. So this is what the sky looks like in neutrinos, and these are very new results combining 3 years of IceCube data. This is a sky map of our events at the final event sample level. This is the northern hemisphere. So again, as I mentioned, these are going to be primarily atmospheric neutrinos. And in the southern hemisphere, these are primarily atmospheric muons. And there are about 100 to 150,000 events in each of these hemispheres. And so, of course, this is kind of useless. So, but we perform this unbend likelihood search on this to look for clustering of high energy events in these hemispheres. And that turns this into a probability map. So again, these are the same data, but this is the likelihood. And then you can say, okay, are there any hot spots here? And well, you can already kind of see there's nothing really that's popping out at this yellow color. If you do go through these data and look for the hottest spots in the northern hemisphere and southern hemisphere, you find these spots. And naively, you might say, oh, hey, look, the p-value here is actually quite small. It's 10 to the minus 4.7, 10 to the minus 4. But of course, you have to remember that we've basically looked everywhere in the sky. And so there's a huge statistical trials penalty for doing that. And so these raw p-values are not significant. And in fact, if you scramble this sky map and figure out what the chance probability is, that this is just background fluctuation, then you see that these are not significant at all. In fact, you have about a 60 and a 98% chance that these are just background fluctuations. So we haven't, with these 3 years of data, we haven't found any static point sources Yep.
Have you done the reverse and taken the nearest AGNs and looked for them?
Yes. And if you remind me, I have a slide in at the very end. We also, in addition to the 3 years of data, we haven't released that list yet. But if you just look at for the IC59 and IC40 source, we also have a source list where we say, okay, these are the interesting sources, and I'll show you the results. That there isn't anything significant there, but we do both of those. So we look everywhere in the sky, and then we only look at interesting sources. For example, Centaurus A. So let me talk about gamma ray burst neutrinos. So these could be interesting, as we've heard, as a possible probe of Lorentz violation. The idea here is no one quite knows what's going on inside a gamma ray burst, but there's some evidence that long GRBs, and long is relative here, they're still only about 10 seconds long, are likely associated with core collapse supernova. And so the idea here is that you have some kind of stellar mass engine that's collapsing, and then you have these highly relativistic jets that first bore out of this stellar envelope. Then you have these internal shocks that are formed in this jet, which produce both the gamma rays that we see in the burst, but also could accelerate protons and via pion production, high energy neutrinos. And then what's not shown here is you also have this jet eventually will hit the surrounding interstellar medium, and you have what's called the GRB afterglow. And you can actually produce neutrinos from any of these phases, the precursor phase, this shock phase, and the afterglow phase. And this globally, these models are called fireball models. And some of them you normalize by saying, okay, GRBs might be one of the places where ultra-high energy cosmic rays are accelerated. And so if that's true, how many neutrinos should they produce? So how we use this as a probe of quantum gravity and specifically Lorentz violation is very similar to the talk we heard yesterday of how you use GRBs in the photon sector to do this. Is that you write some generically modified dispersion relation where you have this this Planck suppressed term here. And then this ends up, this gives you an energy-dependent time delay here, which you can write like this. GRB neutrinos are attractive for this because not only do you have large distances, but you have extremely high energies, so up to 10 to the 18 electron volts. And this is different. This is a wider energy reach than you can get with photons because we don't have this extragalactic background light, which limits how far high-energy photons can propagate to get us. But there are a number of important challenges here. First are these source physics. So I'm not an expert on GRB physics, but already just from the description I gave you, you can see, okay, there are these different phases in this fireball model. And this can already give you intrinsic source delays up to 1,000 seconds or so. The other one is a detector effect, which I also mentioned earlier, and this is how well we can measure the energy difference if we see a couple of neutrinos. this is hard for muon neutrinos, as I told you, and that limits how well you're able to determine this delta E here if you have a couple of neutrinos. But of course, the biggest challenge is you have to detect the neutrinos first. So we've gone and looked for neutrinos from gamma ray bursts. And the way we do this, we have a couple of analyses to do this. We basically take a catalog of gamma ray burst times from Swift, from Integral, from Fermi Burst Monitor. That gives us a time, basically. And then we use whatever other parameters. If the redshift is measured, what are the energies involved? And then we form, we have what we call a model-dependent analysis and a model-independent analysis. So for the model-dependent analysis, the idea is we take all the information we can about the gamma ray burst, We use models out there to construct for each one of these bursts in our sample what the neutrino energy spectrum might look like. And we use the time of this T90 time from the gamma ray burst folks to figure out how long the burst was. At the same time, we say, okay, we don't really know when the neutrinos are going to come out of this fireball, so let's do something a little less constrained. We have what we call a model-independent analysis. It's not totally model-independent because we're still using this T0, but there we just take a window around this T0 and we just keep widening it and widening it up to plus or minus a full day on either side, and then say, do we have any coincident neutrinos from this direction in this time window? And our latest results are using stacked searches. So we stack all of these GRBs together and say, do we have an excess of events? And this is about a 300 GRB sample in these 2 years. And this analysis was particularly, I mean, we've done GRB searches with Amanda and IceCube before, but this analysis was special. And that was because for the first time, we actually are reaching the level where these fireball, standard off-the-shelf fireball model said, you should see neutrinos in this sample. And the hard facts here is that we didn't see neutrinos. So for example, this Guetta et al. Model, which is actually quite conservative in terms of the number of neutrinos predicted 14 events, muon neutrino events, in our final sample, and we saw none. There were two background events. And so this non-observation of GRB neutrinos is the subject of this paper that came out this year in Nature. The upshot is that the fireball theory of GRB, at least neutrino production, has to be significantly revised. And it also is bad news for people who for models which predict that all of the cosmic ray, ultra-high energy cosmic ray flux is produced in GRBs. Some of these models tightly pin the neutrino flux to the GRB proton flux, and those are pretty much completely ruled out. And so, I mean, people are going back to the drawing board and figuring out how to tweak the fireball parameters, but basically what we said is neutrinos are not there at the level.
Can I ask just a very quick question?
Yes.
Because you mentioned three places for neutrinos to come from in the canonical model. Which one of those three places dominates the neutrino flux? Or does it really depend on the model?
That's a good question. And there's also an energy dependence. I do believe that in most models, the neutrino production mostly is expected in this shock phase, so the middle phase. But I think that's model dependent.
Basically, where most of the energy dissipation occurs, because these models are so optimistic, they say at least half the total energy goes into neutrinos.
But is it correct that they try to do so because otherwise they wouldn't explain, they wouldn't create enough cosmic rays? They're pushing the model in order to...
The basic idea why GRBs were suggested is that you need an energy production rate comparable to that seen in gamma rays from GRBs.
Right, so I think we have to revisit that, especially the fraction of energy that is dumped into proton acceleration in basically all of these GRB models. So now you might ask, rightly so, what if we actually have larger time delay effects? Could we possibly see something like that in IceCube? And their answer is maybe if we get lucky. So we don't only rely on GRB triggers and AGN flare times to search for burst data. So we've also, for example, taken the 40 string IceCube data and just looked everywhere in the sky for a time clustering of neutrinos and said, did we find anything significant there? And again, this is the sky map, again, in probability, essentially, here. You can see a couple of hot spots here, this one in the northern hemisphere. is fit best with a 15-second time period in this analysis. But again, unfortunately, this is not significant. So there's a 50% chance or so that this is just, again, a fluctuation of the background. And I just want to posit that at some point we may be able to do a better job of quantum gravity or Lorentz violation time delay sources, but with a stacking analysis where we're really doing an energy and Z-dependent stacking source. But we need neutrinos for that first. So the last topic I want to talk to you today are searches for ultra-high energy neutrinos. We heard this morning from Marcos about the GZK effect. So this is, I'll just remind you, this is when high energy protons at the very end of the cosmic ray spectrum interact with the cosmic microwave background. You get neutrinos produced, again, from pion decay. And there are a couple of proposals out there from some of the audience members, in fact, of how one might use these ultra-high energy neutrinos. These are from 10 to the 17 to 10 to the 19 electron volts to look for example, Lorentz violation. You might have Lorentz violating neutrino splitting as these propagate to the Earth, which basically changes the spectrum. And this is David and Stefano and others have looked at. And also, if you like large extra dimensions, we might be able to see a change in the neutrino cross-section at ultra-high energies, again, by looking at how an event rate in our detector changes based on how much Earth we went through before being detected. And this is described in this paper by Amy Connolly and others. So you guys know what the GZK effect is, and this is a plot from Auger showing this cosmic ray turnoff. And just to remind you, the neutrino connection here is we have these pion productions, but a key question that, again, we heard this morning is that we don't know if the ultra-high energy cosmic rays are protons or not. They might, in fact, be iron nuclei. This actually would be terrible news for us in IceCube looking for these. Because like an iron nucleus tends to photodisintegrate first, and eventually it will produce high energy neutrinos, but is at a substantially reduced level from kind of the canonical GZK process. And you can see in this model here by Ankur Dukui et al, the best fit proton prediction for GZK neutrinos versus a range of predictions for iron. Primaries, and you can see these are reduced by one or two orders of magnitude. However, if we do measure this, we could answer the question, which Marcus brought up this morning, is this really the GZK effect, or is it the source is running out of steam? So that's another reason to go look for it. So the latest results that I can show you here are hot off the press. So here we're using the two latest full years of IceCube data up until May of this year. So the IC79 and first year of IC86 data. We wanted to do a simple analysis here. And so the main selection criteria for these events are just a high number of photoelectrons in the detector. So we just want a lot of light dumped into the detector. And you can see this does actually correlate quite well with energy. This is Monte Carlo here. This is the log of the neutrino energy here. And this is this NPE variable. And at some really high energies, this is 10 to the 18, 17, 18, we do start to saturate the detector. But below that, it actually tracks neutrino energy pretty well. This is essentially a super quick overview of how we design the analysis cuts to cut out the background of this. So this is background Monte Carlo. This is basically cosmic ray muons. And here is this NPE variable. And this is a reconstructed zenith angle here. And this is for upgoing and for downgoing events. And with this energy cut, we can reduce the background to a tenth of event in all of these 2 years. We verify this by essentially taking 10% of the experimental data and looking to make sure that our Monte Carlo makes sense, and then we throw that data away for the analysis and only use the remaining 90%. And so you can see the most of the data here, as expected, matches the background Monte Carlo, and this is what we expect from a GZK-type signal. So it's clustered here, close to the horizon, and at high energies. So when we unblinded this earlier this summer, we actually got a bit of a surprise and found two cascade events in the data sample. And I'll remind you, the background estimation was about a tenth of event. And this is not statistically significant yet. Just a very preliminary estimate is this is only about a 2-sigma effect. But here are the events. They're quite interesting. They're extremely clean, high-energy cascade events. And we nicknamed them Bird and Ernie. It's easier than event 3, 6, 5, 5, 6, 7, 0, 5. And our preliminary energy reconstructions are that this is about a 1.1 PeV neutrino event, and this is about a 1.3 PeV neutrino event. And so the obvious question, which we're trying to answer as quickly as possible, is what are these events? And there are a couple of possibilities. The good news is that there's absolutely no indication so far that they're background cosmic ray muons. So we don't see a muon track sneaking in the side of the detector. There's no activity in the ice top surface array. So we don't think that they're background. If you just plot the expected event rates here versus this NPE energy proxy, you can kind of get an idea of what the possibilities might be. So this is just the background atmospheric flux. This is where that 0.1 number came from. One possibility is that we're starting to see atmospheric charm neutrino productions. But again, the leading models here are about an order of magnitude under what we would expect. So that's not really a great explanation either. Now, here are the GZK fluxes. And there, actually, we would have expected to first see neutrinos of a little higher energy because of this characteristic humped spectrum that they have. So the fact that they're right here at the edge of the analysis is a little suspicious, and in my opinion suggests, okay, maybe they're not GZK neutrinos. Another exciting possibility is that we might be starting to see an extragalactic diffuse flux of high energy neutrinos from the ensemble of cosmic ray accelerators in the universe. And roughly this should follow approximately an e to the minus 2 energy to the minus 2 power law spectrum. And if you just plot the current best limit that we have set in IceCube, this is also the world best limit, that's this green line here. And it's actually at about the right level where these data points fit. But, you know, I don't draw any conclusions from that. I just think it's suggestive at this point. But we're quickly doing a follow-up analysis. The obvious next question is, hey, what's down here? Is this really a power law spectrum here? And so we have an analysis in progress right now where we're going to extend this to lower energies. This will be an all-flavor analysis, so we're not just limited to muon neutrino events. And there are some really clever veto techniques where we essentially use the outer ring of modules in IceCube as a veto to veto atmospheric muon and downgoing atmospheric neutrino events. So that, I think, those results I'm really eager to see. So to conclude, IceCube is completed and it's operating quite well. Atmospheric neutrinos are and will remain our high statistics source. So in Amanda, we use these data to set limits on quantum decoherence and on violation of Lorentz invariance. And a question that I will pose to you is we have a lot more data now. Is it interesting to keep looking for these effects in atmospheric neutrinos? We can certainly improve the reach of these analyses. We just need to go and do it. obviously, we'd love to extend the searches to higher energies and longer baselines. The hard facts that I want to leave you with, for at least from IceCube's perspective, is that GRB neutrinos are not at the level predicted by fireball models, although those are being now revised. but a lot of them are severely constrained, and GRBs may not be the source of ultra-high energy cosmic rays. And we have ongoing searches for other neutrino point sources, but we haven't found anything yet. But again, we haven't analyzed even the first full year of IC86 data there. The high energy, we also have these high energy searches ongoing for this diffuse flux and for cosmogenic neutrinos. And we don't have a significant excess so far, but I think these two events are quite interesting. If they hold up, they'll be the highest energy neutrinos ever observed. And my hope, and this is kind of a goofy metaphor, this is a sunrise at the at the South Pole from just a few weeks ago, is that this may eventually provide the next test beam for this type of new physics searches. So thank you.
Have you stacked up supernova?
Yes, although there is... For depends on whether you mean supernova remnants or actually supernova happening.
Happenings, because that's where we've ever seen neutrinos. But
yes.
Tell me remnants too.
Yeah. So yes, we have done. So supernova remnants fall in this that might be a candidate for galactic cosmic rays, and those are in this analysis of selected sources. This is actually an unstacked analysis where we've looked at various various sources. Some of these are galactic supernova remnants. I haven't found anything there, but I believe we've also done a stacked supernova remnant analysis. So we have 13 of these on this list. for supernovas, I didn't get to go into this, but IceCube is actually, if a galactic supernova goes off, we will definitely see it. But it's by a completely different detection channel. And we actually have a parallel data acquisition system running to look for a supernova. And the way that that works is, if you just look at the noise rate of the optical module, so this is noise rate versus time of a single optical module, this is going at about 500 hertz or so. And so what we look for is a collective rise in the noise rate of all of these optical modules simultaneously. So we're looking for MEV neutrinos. So there's no big track or cascade that we can look for, but there's a bunch of light deposited across the whole detector. And so if you combine these, you would actually see a significant spike in the overall noise rate. And so this is what we're looking for. In terms of galactic supernova, we might, I can't remember off the top of my head whether we're sensitive to like an LMC supernova, but we're not sensitive to certainly beyond that. So we would need a new detector to really reach into, say, the local group.
I wanted to comment about GRBs. One, the models for the neutrino emission were as optimistic as possible. Like, occurs in other fields as long as it's not ruled out by observations. But a very slight tweaking, some would argue, to more realistic values, you can be consistent with current observations. And the second point is that for the cosmic rays, you can, in principle, produce the cosmic rays that requires accelerating the protons or eons, whatever. But to produce a neutrino, they need to interact, either P gamma, P, whatever. And that's two separate issues, depending on the exact condition that the prompt emission location, assuming that's indeed where most of the energy is dissipated. And if you put it far away, where the energy density of the photons and other targets is small enough, then it could be consistent with the urbanism.
Yep, and I don't want to suggest that the fireball picture is wrong. It's just that there's this gap between, as you said, between modeling the gamma ray emission and then modeling the neutrino emission, and there's a long chain. And you're right. If for example you look at this recent paper by Hummer and Walter Winter and others, so they argue that just by a more careful numerical simulation of this model, you can reduce the neutrino flux by about an order of magnitude. So,
well, yeah. If you put in all the model assumptions that go into all that, it can be many orders of magnitude.
Yeah.
One more question? You limit your research for a day on either side. You're collecting what determined the day? Is it harder to go past that, or are you just that?
No, I mean, it's obviously a day is a pretty arbitrary human chosen number, but I didn't really go into this result plot, but what this plot shows here is the number of expected events, and this is hard to read, but this is the time window again that we go on either side, starting from plus or minus 10 seconds up to plus or minus 10,000 seconds. And I mean the point is here is that once you get out too far, you're just you lose sensitivity, obviously, because you're just getting more and more background. And so it's just a trade-off between what's realistically going to test these models and how much background you can let in. And so obviously, it's the wider the window, the more background, so the less sensitive we are.
What's the highest energy neutrino you have detected to show?
That's 1.3 PeV, so that's Ernie.
No, but when you say these are still candidates.
Oh. Yes. That's kind of phraseology, right? I mean, all of our, even the atmospheric neutrinos that we observe have some probability of being a misreconstructed background event. Those, if you just look at... We have pretty good statistics just in the atmospheric neutrino spectrum up to about 100 TV or a few hundred TV or so. And so, I mean, again, because this follows the prediction quite nicely, we're reasonably confident that these events are indeed atmospheric neutrinos and not background. And so these are a bit shy of the 1 PeV mark here.
So... do I understand right that except for Ernie and his friend, you don't have any non-atmospheric neutrinos?
That is correct. I mean, there might be some. I mean, in the big sky map of black dots, but we don't know which ones. Mm-hmm. But that's correct. Yep. And Bert and Ernie may also be atmospheric neutrino background. So I hope not, but.
So one thing I noticed about Bert and Ernie is, as you said, they're very close to your low energy cutoff. And while you finally did come up with a spectrum that looked like it was at least peaked in their region, it also looked really flat.
Yes.
So I would have been somewhat surprised to see two events, even on a log plot, two events so close together at the bottom edge. Are you guys worried about that? Or?
Yes, definitely. I mean, the what we're always paranoid about is of course that it's quite difficult to model misreconstructed events. So events that we just completely misunderstand the energy or the direction of because the ice is weird or because they snuck in below the detector and the light shined upward into ice cube. And so there's all these pathological cases that we think we understand, but we're not totally sure. What we want it to be, When we first looked at these results, a number of people said, "Okay, let's look immediately below this into the background region to see, okay, is this just a sample of background events that we've misunderstood?" But we decided actually to be more careful than that because that would essentially be unblinding a new search without really proper procedures in place. And we try to be very careful not to do kind of Wild West analyses. And so that's kind of why we're waiting to look at this lower energy. So it may indeed be that they're background, but I think we should know pretty soon. So.
Thank you.
We have a few more minutes for a discussion if one of us talk amongst. So. All right, let's get
Thank you.